it's great to have you here and to show your approach and what you have done. And I think the students here are pretty oriented in the shelter standards and what they say. And you had also discussions with them directly. So it's you have, and the shelter center, I see them, you can correct me if I'm wrong, as they are sort of the UN guys, you know, or big NGOs, Red Cross guys, people. And they are doing their documentation process. And then we have Vinay. Yeah, would you say, you're not a UN guy, but you're the one guy that does a lot of stuff.
I'm kind of an open source guy. Fundamentally, I mean, open source guy in academic energy policy background.
Yeah. And you have done a lot of development work, and what I realized that you have done great solutions that I really like, and also this idea of open source within this project, that we actually can develop something, like plugins you could call it, you know, that you could use with a Hexaift if we would think that was needed. And that's a very nice approach, and I've used a lot of open source when trying to administrate this blog that we have for the emergency housing. We're using plugins that everybody else wrote, and we're putting together something that works for us. And that's a very great system. So. Very welcome, we're glad to have you here. And yeah, now I'll be quiet.
Thank you. Dumped. So was there anything else you wanted to touch on before we wade in? Because once we get going, we're going.
Yeah, I think we can go now. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I guess my understanding is that about half of you are industrial designers and about half of you are artists. Is that about right?
Industrial design engineers.
And the other group are primarily designers and artists, or artists? Give me some notion where you're coming from.
Wow.
Some industrial designers and some people from, I don't know what you are from.
Yeah, yeah. Those who are not industrial designers, tell me what you do.
From interior architecture?
Yeah.
Interior architecture, okay. So that's basically interior design, furniture. Do you handle mechanical systems like HVAC? Things like keeping buildings hot and cool, do you handle those kind of factors?
No.
Okay, so it's the design of interior spaces.
Mm.
Furniture?
Yes.
Okay. Excellent. Good. Because actually, once we get into this stuff, one of the major areas that's missing from the way that we currently design refugee systems is that there's no furniture. And a lot of times, for example, people talk about building a floor system that will keep people off the floor in muddy conditions and this kind of stuff. And you don't actually want to build a floor over an entire shelter because people are heavy and flooring is difficult and you wind up, you know, the floor is often twice as expensive as the shelter. What you need are things like insulated beds that will move people off the ground and also keep them dry. So there's a lot of room in there for emergency furniture, which is a parallel with emergency shelter and solves some of the problems that are naturally sheltering problems. There's actually a ton of terrain in there. Anyway, so we're going to do basically three 40-minute blocks which cover different sides of the shelter stuff. The first one, make sure all my gear works here. Aha. So the first one, understanding poverty and disasters. Actually looking at what poverty is and how it interacts with this whole field that you call disaster relief. Because that interface is not commonly understood and it's not heavily talked about, but it's actually where all of the opportunities are to really solve these problems in a deep way rather than in a shallow way. And what I mean by a deep solution is a deep solution solves the problem and the problem doesn't come back. So you're not talking about a band-aid where you apply the solution once you have a problem. We're talking about deep structural changes in the way that societies which are vulnerable work, which leave them protected in the long run and in the future. Understanding poverty and disaster. The other thing I want to say is if you've got questions, interrupt me. You know, raise your hand, yell, throw things. But we're going to cover a lot of material, a lot of which is kind of controversial and a lot of which might not make sense immediately. So ask questions because each piece builds on the piece before it. And I don't want you to be in a position where you disagreed with a point and then none of the stuff that comes afterward makes sense. So let's begin. So our current situation, right? This is the number of people in the world, 5 billion, 6 billion. This is their income. So this is $1 a day, is about 1.2 billion. $10 a day is about 4.5 billion. $100 a day, so that's $36,000 a year, which is about, it's kind of truck driver salaries. When you get up to this $100 a day mark, there's really only about a billion people who earn more than $100 a day. It might be a little less than that. So at this kind of $10 a day level, your diet is primarily rice and beans. You've got basic medical care, you have a cell phone, your house probably has electricity, but it's probably not super reliable. In many cases, you'll own a TV set, occasionally you'll have a motorbike or a car. When you get down to $1 a day, you have just about enough calories to make it as long as nothing weird happens to your economy. And, for example, remember there was this bubble of, there was an increase in food prices because of biofuels about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago? So what you saw was this kind of area in here, where people aren't quite starving, but they're kind of economically marginal, food prices doubled. And suddenly a lot of those people who'd been fairly comfortable pushed back into absolute poverty where they were really kind of short of calories. Something like 30 million people got pushed down that curve, and you saw civil unrest all over the world in response to that in urban areas. Because if you live in a slum, then you don't grow any of your own food and you're economically dependent on market prices to eat. And you've only got just enough money for food, you're not really spending very much money on anything else. So if your food prices double, you go into absolute hunger. It's basically an economic famine. And this curve, this is the background of disaster relief. If you think of almost any natural disaster other than Hurricane Katrina that happened in a developed world area, by and large, developed world people are wealthy enough to rescue themselves. You know, you can have some inconvenience, but at the end of the day, if you stand on a street corner with a handful of $20 bills in your pocket, it doesn't really matter what kind of problem you have, somebody will come and figure out how to help you. And this is really important to understand. Market pricing for emergency services is fairly cheap. You know, if you had enormous flooding in Holland, most of the Dutch are not going to starve. Somebody's going to come and sell them rubber boots. People from neighboring countries with pumping equipment will come to help. Their own government has a good deal of reserve and is fairly flexible, and they'll basically just kind of take care of the problem. If that same thing happens in Bangladesh, the people don't have any food reserves, the government doesn't have any money, nobody around has pumping equipment. If they did, they're not going to bring it there because you're going to lose some of your equipment, there's no money to replace it. Same physical situation affects people completely differently depending on how much money they have and how much reserve they have, and their access to outside help is enormously affected by the amount of money that they have to spend. If you looked at any of the major disasters that we've seen recently, and you basically just walked up there with, you know, 500 or 1,000 pounds, you know, dollars in cash and handed it to each of the disaster victims, most of these situations would resolve themselves pretty quickly. Does this all kind of make sense? Yes? Yes. Well, in Hurricane Katrina, 2,000 Americans died because of government incompetence, right? I mean, they were already very poor, right? You've got some of what happened in New Orleans is poverty, but the real killer was this mix of poverty and bureaucracy. So you had lots of military resources, you had lots of civilian resources, you had lots of people attempting to self-rescue by getting the hell out of the city, being turned back by police from the bridges because they weren't going to have all these poor black people running into middle-class areas. And Hurricane Katrina was completely predictable. The disaster unfolded exactly as it did in federal disaster plans that went back 30 years. Why did 2,000 people die? Right? A disaster that had days of warning, that proceeded exactly as everybody expected it to from the government preparation, you still had 2,000 Americans die. That's two-thirds as many people died in 9/11. And our response to 9/11 was to invade two countries that had very little to do with it. And spend something like $3 trillion. You know, there's kind of a mismatch here in terms of risk analysis. So the reason that I took Katrina to one side is that in Katrina, what you have an example of is government bureaucracy, which is as bad as poverty. And this is something that you quite often see, where the government bureaucracy is so bad, they're unable to spend money on a solution. Look, we can buy this thing, it costs $500, it will solve the problem. Well, we've got to do 3 years of studies before we can invest in it. Okay, but in the meantime, you have no money and you still have a problem. It's poverty caused by bureaucracy. It's the inability to spend on the solution. And Katrina had some elements of that, but mainly it was just an absolute disaster of bureaucracy. Does that answer your question? Okay, so next. Boom. This is not an expected number, but every year, 60 million people die of all causes. Old age, disease, hunger, accidents, the entire spectrum of stuff. 60 million people die. Of that number, about 30 million are dying because of poverty. Now, how big that number is depends on who you ask. Food and Agriculture Organization says that 36 million people a year die of reasons which have some aspect of malnutrition. So what they're talking about is bits of vitamin deficiency, you know, a life without quite enough food security. You know, they're talking about all of these contributory causes. They're not talking about 36 million people starving. They're talking about small effects that add up. The number who actually just plain die of various causes, hunger, 3-ish million, waterborne disease, 2, 3, 4, 5 million, depends who you ask. Cooking fires turns out to be a huge issue. If you spend your entire life cooking over an open fire, it turns out to be the equivalent of, you know, smoking 2 or 3 packs of cigarettes a day. And people are starting to cook at the age of 5, 6, 7, 8. All of this stuff together forms this thing that I call the poverty cluster. And it's medical care, overwork, nutrition, vaccinations, stress. There's a whole list of things which generally lower your quality of life and lower your length of life. Yes?
Where do these statistics come from?
This is kind of a basket of stats. If I go back, I'll show you the slides later on, but at the bottom I've got the URLs of the actual studies, so I'll send you the PDFs. When you start looking, there's a longer talk that I did on this, which is on the internet, called Saving the World Through Open Source, that really digs into the statistics side of it. The basic case is that everybody double counts. So if you ask the water people how many people die of waterborne diseases, they'll give you a huge number. And they'll say water contributes to this many deaths. If you ask the cooking fire people how many people die of smoke inhalation, they'll give you a huge number and they'll say it contributes to this many deaths. Because what you see isn't that people die of one clearly identifiable cause. What you get is a general decline in health because of all of these interacting factors. So when you want to try and nail it down to a hard number of this many people die of this cause, what you actually get in the statistics is a lot of arm waving. So it makes more sense to go back and say, well, if you put all of these numbers together, you get this kind of bundle. And I think the actual death toll that's really just plain old poverty and infrastructure failure and all the rest of this stuff is about 10 million. But it really depends who you ask and how they want to count. It's a bunch of people, and it's very hard to define in hard terms. But if you go through, you know, each one of these causes has a specific group at the UN or a specific charity associated with it who give you their ballpark estimates. And what they don't do is any real examination of the overlaps and the synergies. So I don't want to say I'm guessing, but it's looking at the statistics and making a best interpretation. Half is probably the influence, of which about 1/6 are hardcore, these people just died of being poor, period. Does that help? So why doesn't this stuff affect us? This is a thing that we call 6 ways to die. And there are basically 6 ways that your body can stop working. You could be too hot, too cold, hungry, thirsty, you can have an illness, or you can have an injury. And these are the 6 fundamental causes of human mortality. Now, by and large, very, very, very few people in the developed world die of anything except illness. You get a handful of injuries. You get illnesses in old age. All the other causes stopped killing us in large numbers, usually hundreds of years ago. I'm trying to think, when was the last big famine in Sweden? Anybody know? 300, 400, 500 years, probably?
No, 1800s.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for it to be remembered 200 years later, you probably had significant mortality, right? Probably that's the last time that you had a significant number of people in Sweden starve. You go to Iceland, they had some pretty serious trouble after one of the volcanic eruptions. Ireland had the potato famine. I mean, it's not a really, really long time ago that you had people starving to death in Europe, but it's been a good, you know, half a dozen generations. So the reason this stuff doesn't happen anymore is that what we've built up is these very complex infrastructures that protect us from this stuff. So I'm just going to go out from the ring. Individual infrastructure is the stuff that you carry with you or you have in your pockets. Household is all the services in your house. Town is all the services that are provided at a municipal level. So, for example, your water supply is typically purified at a town level. In a lot of places, your power supply is done at a town level. Then you go out to the regional systems. And regional systems are things like transport infrastructure, major hospitals, fuel supply, fuel transport. All that stuff is kind of regional. And then you get out to the global level, which is primarily markets. Your fuel markets, your food markets, and all the rest of the stuff. So if we just take food as an example. So this is the transportation network that most of your food travels through. And on the international level, it's things like ports. And you get down to the local level, it's roads. And then food is warehoused at the town level in stores and in the warehouses of stores. Then when you want to cook it, you've got energy that comes from these international grids all the way around and is combined with your food in your kitchen, and it turns into something you can eat, and this is why we don't have hunger. Very little of the food is actually grown locally. The vast majority of it is taken internationally. And you know, you've got this weird situation where all countries are exporting food and all countries are importing food. There's very little local self-sufficiency. Even if you're producing enough food to survive, typically you don't eat what you grow, you actually export it to make money to import it from somewhere else. Not a terribly efficient process, but that's how we do it. We come over here, the water grid, right? Again, very little action at the international level, lots of action at the regional level, where you've got purification, transport, storage, comes around to the household level. Your sanitation, the reason we don't typically get sick is we have sewers, right? London, do you guys know about the ghost map? This guy called John Snow. So London had a cholera, which was a waterborne epidemic in 56. And people were dying of cholera, and nobody knew at that point what cholera was or where it came from. But a scientist drew a map showing all the people who died in London and saw that they were all clustered around a given well. So they investigated the few people who had died and who didn't live close to that well, and discovered that they drank water from that well because they happened to work in the area, or somebody had taken the water from there, or something along these lines. And once they'd ascertained the problem was the well, the guy went down to the town area and just took the handle off the well to stop people using it. And sure enough, when they investigated, they discovered that there was a sewage pipe that was very close to the well, and you'd gotten contaminated water. So that's 150 years ago in London. You had people dying of, you know, waterborne pandemic disease. And all of this stuff that was built in as a result of those kind of situations is the water infrastructure. What the Victorian era is famous for is building sewers, gigantic brick pipes underneath everything. You go out, you know, there's a whole pile of stuff there. You go out to injury, primarily what protects us is armies and police protect us from violence, and all of our safety regulations protect us from actually being injured. And hospitals will patch us up if we do get hurt. So this system is the Western infrastructure model, and it's fairly static. You know, industrial cities all over the world, and the rest of society in the West and most of the middle class countries. Europe all pretty much looks like this. America all pretty much looks like this. All the urban areas look like this outside of the slums. Does all kind of make sense? Now, what happens if you lose a chunk of this infrastructure, right? I mean, if you take, you know, the electrical infrastructure. If you guys have an electrical infrastructure failure, your power grid goes down because there's some terrible winter conditions. Your houses are big, they're fairly warm, many of them have stoves, you've got access to fuel wood, you've got lots of clothing, you've got access to money to buy things like gas heaters if you need them in an emergency. Right? If you go to some country like Afghanistan, where the Afghan power infrastructure is they get wood and they burn it, and they don't have tons of additional money and tons of additional clothing and tons of additional everything else, right? You've got this Afghan earthquake that knocked over, I don't know, 600,000 houses, something like this. Anybody remember the number? Might have been 300,000 houses. Anyway, it left about 3 million people without their conventional access to shelter or various other essential services. And you'd all these people freezing to death in these mountain valleys. And the equipment that the NGOs took out there had never been tested in heavy winter conditions and just didn't work. They had no effective rehousing solution for the Afghan refugees because that was the first time they'd had a cold weather disaster at altitude. And it was a real humanitarian crisis that the NGOs did not respond to in a particularly effective way. They didn't have a plan ready to go, and there was a lot of trial and error when they got out there trying to find some kind of tent system that would survive the weather conditions. So when you lack resilience, what happens is that when something goes wrong, you don't have any ability to get yourself out of trouble. actually, I'm going to skip forward to here, right? Pre-existing poverty is what makes people fragile to disasters. You're already poor, you're already marginal economically. When something goes wrong, you've got no ability to dig yourself out of the hole. Does that kind of make sense? Okay. So I'm gonna skip back here very briefly. So alternative models, right? If you want high standard living and a long life, do you need to build all of this stuff? Do you need to modernize? Do you need to industrialize? Do you need to be somewhere way up on the income curve? The answer is no. Kerala, it's a state in India, 60 million people, 76-year life expectancy, dollar a day average income, 99.5% literacy, basically European birth rates. How did they manage it? Nobody really knows. They call it the Kerala model. It's also informally known as the Kerala miracle. How are they managing to make that work? There just isn't a really good, clean answer. Their government had a different set of investment priorities than most governments. They had a very different economic model. They had some natural advantages, like they had their population already had a long history of learning and education. But at the end of the day, it's an extremely remarkable situation that you can get Western life expectancy on a dollar a day. That's not something that anybody expected, but the numbers are good, and it's just not really clear how they're achieving it. There are some real questions about, you know, just how was that done? Yes? In English, there are a couple of books, neither of which I found terribly satisfactory, and there's a whole bunch of journalism, but given how remarkable it is, there's really a very, very deep absence of solid work on it. I don't know why every developing world country in the world doesn't have an embassy there trying to figure out what they're doing and copying it. Doesn't seem to be happening. Why is that? Well, I mean, you know, the problem could be something to do with this. Right? If it turns out that there's some form of communism that actually works, there are a lot of people who'd be very uncomfortable to discover that. And exactly what democratically elected market communism is as a political system, I'm not really sure anybody understands. You know, it doesn't sound like it's actually communism because there's no sense of it being a command economy, and they're democratically elected. So is it some kind of European socialist model that's being implemented with the very poor? It's really hard to get hard information about it. I keep meaning to try and get some funding to go out there and spend a couple of years on the ground just mapping what they're doing, but so far no luck. Other stuff along these lines. So distributed infrastructure and sustainable development. So if we go forward, there are other ways of arranging your infrastructure which keep it more or less all at the household level. So if you need power, you've got little windmills, you've got little solar panels. You can do far more in terms of keeping your houses warm and cool. If you work with particularly traditional housing models, are often really good at this. Energy efficient wood stoves for cooking, solar cookers, local food storage and local food growing. There's a whole bunch of work on radically increasing the agricultural output of developing world areas based on organic agriculture techniques. There's a paper by a woman called Yvette Perfecto that says that rural farmers in the developing world could increase their food output by about 80% using organic farming techniques. And that's the end of world hunger, using no more ecological resources. I mean, that's kind of important. Again, how much funding do they have? Not a heck of a lot. Water, there's a whole bunch of household level water and sanitation technologies, Sulab toilets, Potters for Peace water filters, solar water pasteurization, solar water disinfection. There's a whole suite of technologies that can handle sewage and drinking water issues on a house-by-house basis. And there's also a whole bunch of medical stuff along these lines as well. So you could talk about providing all of these essential services at the household or occasionally the village level, which provides you with the possibility of a very high standard of living without having to go all the way up this curve. And right now, one of the things that nobody knows is whether we have enough natural resources to have all that many more rich people. The current evidence is that we don't have enough natural resources to support the rich people we have, never mind 5 billion more of them. So there are potentially extremely hard natural resource limits that will prevent us increasing the size of the rich portion of society without completely destroying the world as we know it. And when people talk about ecological collapse, what they're talking about is the planet collapsing under the weight of the existing rich populations because the resource footprint is so enormous. And
you know, if people are particularly interested in that, I can revisit it, but it's not particularly relevant to disaster relief. So we'll move on. So bottom line, what is a disaster? Something bad happens, earthquake, right? Boom. Some people immediately die. They're killed in the collapse, the buildings fall on them, you know, they're gone. Infrastructure breaks down. So water and sanitation is probably the first thing to go because those systems are really fragile. Power grid goes down. You're left with the sort of chaos of a post-disaster setting. Something like two-thirds of all disasters are what they call wet disasters, which are floods, storms, tsunamis, and this kind of stuff. And those tend to be really, really hard to deal with because all of your water gets contaminated. And at that point, you've got water everywhere, but none of it's safe to drink. So once that immediate crunch has happened, then you get this rebuilding phase. In developer disasters, rich self-rescue. Remember these enormous fires that you saw in around the San Diego area last year? Were these bushfires? About the same number of people were displaced as were displaced in Hurricane Katrina. An enormous number of people had to leave their houses. I think, I'm talking very loosely, don't hold me to these numbers, but an enormous number of people had to move. Does anybody hear about there being any significant problems as a result of that?
No.
Right. Most of them rented hotel rooms or went to stay with their sister up the coast. They were wealthy people. They could by and large transport themselves. They by and large had somewhere to go. If they didn't, they had access to credit. It just wasn't a problem. So the problem case is this. Poor people often die before the rebuilding occurs or before they rebuild. Because if you're making a dollar a day and your house washes away and your farm washes away, you have no money to do anything with. So you're now basically living on a patch of ground with no food, waiting for the next harvest, if it ever comes. And this is the fundamental mechanics of disaster. The real damage is when you take poverty and then you have a very sudden system perturbation, right? You've got people who are economically marginal, they're hanging on by their fingernails, a disaster comes through and they go from just about making it to not making it at all. And that's where the dying happens. Does this kind of make sense? Now this is a very different model from the conventional models of disaster relief, partly because of the history of where disaster relief comes from. Most of the stuff that you think of as disaster relief is basically modeled on the UN model, the Red Cross model. And the Red Cross model is basically, they turned up on battlefields in Europe sometime around, 1870, 1890, handing out blankets and food to soldiers. So they had to be extremely political and be neutral so that neither side would think the other side was getting unfair advantage. And they had a very fixed, very limited set of things that they were allowed to do on the battlefield without becoming combatants, without becoming, offending the armies on one side or another. So what happened is that other NGOs kind of copied this model, and you got this idea that we've got a fixed, limited set of things we're going to do, we're going to turn up, we're going to provide aid, we're going to leave. And that model got very deeply ground into the disaster relief world. Then you get World War II Europe, and you have millions and millions and millions of displaced people in Europe and enormous warehouses full of army surplus from the various combatant nations. And you take the army surplus, you have volunteers who give it out, and you go and you rehouse these people in what are essentially military encampments, but without any military people in them. Demilitarized military encampments. And that's where you get your standard template refugee camp from. All these orderly rows of tents, one after another, all alike. X, Y grid, north, south aligned, central services for water and power and all the rest of that stuff. It's a military camp from World War II, rebuilt by the NGOs in the present. These fundamental mental models have been carried forward through time. And it turns out that, what worked in post-war Europe, where you had tons of army surplus and lots of trained soldiers, doesn't tend to work so well in the developing world, where you're dealing with people who are farmers, they lack education, they're already economically marginal, they have no real interest in living in a tent for 2 years, and you're not really giving them a choice about it. And there's all of these cultural issues around that. And then there's this simple fact that demilitarized military camps are not really how people would choose to live. And there are all kinds of problems that that model doesn't address, because that model was for, you know, young men in huge numbers with massive supply chains bringing in food and ammunition every day. When you start looking at what families need and what you need to develop economic self-sufficiency, you wind up with a completely different set of problems. Do you see what I'm saying? Like this way of regimented tents, and every tent is the same, and you don't have any trade inside of the camp, and you don't have any provision for agriculture, you don't have any provision for education. It's what happens when you apply a conceptual model that was built for a military situation, and you just take the guns out and then apply it to a civilian population. Civilian populations have much more complex needs, because you've got old people, you've got young people, you've got sick people, you don't have these huge convoys bringing in food and gear. It's a completely different situation. But the NGO model has not really adapted past this kind of demilitarized post-World War II kind of setup. So, I'm going a little out of order. System interventions, right? How do you change this situation? First thing is, we've established poverty is why these populations are so vulnerable. Transitional solutions, right? Transitional housing basically takes this model, right? So you've got the military camp model. The tents last for a year because ultraviolet light eats plastic. Do you know this? Come across this? So any plastic object, thin plastic that's been outdoors for a long time, gets thin and it gets brittle and it gets stiff and then it tears and falls to pieces. And it's very, very hard to stop that happening. Even if you use chemical treatments in the plastic, at the end of the day, ultraviolet light is, you know, really, really corrosive in the long run to plastic type things. And just about all tents are made of plastic or they're made of canvas. Sunlight rots everything. And as a result, the transitional model is, well, the tents have fallen to pieces and these people are still not in a position where they've rebuilt their houses. Now what do we do with them? And that's where the transitional model comes from. But transitional housing is not really enough, because if you just give these people houses, you haven't solved their problem. Well, now they have a house, but they still don't have any income, so they're now starving in the nice house you gave them. You see what I'm saying? You need to start thinking about what's the fundamental goal of disaster relief. And my contention is that it's to restore economic self-sufficiency, so that you put people back in a position where they can feed themselves, then you leave. And at that point, what we've got is a goal which is the same goal as development. There's no fundamental division between disaster relief and development. You go there, you take care of the immediate problem, they still have all the problems they had before, but their capital is gone. How are we doing for time? Give me
45 minutes until coffee break.
45 minutes until coffee break.
Yeah,
so I should wrap this section up, then we should take a little breather.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm very briefly going to talk about capital, and then we'll take a couple of questions and stop. So capital is the key, right? Does anybody want to give a definition of capital? Anybody kind of know what it is? Somebody take a shot. Somebody did economics. Yeah?
You can have an intellectual capital, or you can have a machine, or you can have like a piece of forest or something.
Mm-hmm. What do they all have in common?
It's power.
Power. Very good. Oh, I'll buy that. It's good. Any other definitions of capital? So, in general, whether it's an area of forest, whether it's training and education, whether it's a pile of money, capital produces something useful just by existing. Or you give it a little energy and it returns you something really useful in return. So it's kind of like an amplifier, or it's a, like a well, but what comes out of it is something that you want. And the reason that the countries that we're in are so wealthy is they've got lots and lots and lots of streams of lots of reserves of capital in different forms that produce a stream of wealth that we all live on, right? We each have a share in the cultures around us that supports us with this enormous jet of wealth that just, you know, sprays out of these cultures. They're like geysers of money. They really are, right? I mean, there's just, the West is a geyser of money. And that's a combination of hundreds of years of really serious cultural focus on education. It's relatively effective forms of government, although they have some problems now. It's all of these factors that come from stability and reinvestment over many, many, many centuries. And the result is that we are rich without really having to try very hard. In other parts of the world that didn't have these advantages, and sometimes these cultures had these advantages hundreds of years ago and it was destroyed by colonialism, sometimes they just never had those advantages, sometimes it's wiped out by disease. In any case, in places where you don't have these enormous reserves of capital, people are living hand to mouth. They have to scratch out a little money and then they eat it, and then they scratch out a little more money and then they eat it, and there's never this huge buildup of reserve that gives them resilience at a financial level. And without that, what happens is when something goes wrong in the system, they run into real problems. So the fundamental structure is that a disaster comes through and it destroys whatever capital they had, or at least destroys a part of it. And that can take the return on their investment from being enough to feed them to being not enough to feed them. And thinking about this in terms of restoring their access to capital gets into things like microcredit, it gets into things like land grants, it gets into improving their farming methodologies. All of this is about building up their capital reserves to the point where they can live effectively from their own resources. Does that kind of make sense? So this is sort of a loosely economic model of disaster, and what comes out of it is an emphasis on doing things differently from the way that they're normally done in a disaster setting. And that includes really questioning this connection between, you know, really looking at this divide between emergency relief and transitional shelter, transitional housing, and saying, actually, we kind of have to think in a whole systems way. The objective is to get these people back down into a situation where their death rate is something that we find acceptable, and that includes thinking about their access to capital, one form or another, to support themselves. Reasonable? Okay, so, done. That's the end of the first section. Any questions? Example? Yes, good.
Okay, so isn't that an impossible task?
I don't know.
I mean, if you're saying that it's fundamentally the same as development work,
mm-hmm.
right, and so you move into any area that has any kind of an emergency situation,
mm-hmm.
and you apply development techniques,
mm-hmm.
development work takes a lot of time,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of resources.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that? How do
well,
you fund it? What's the structure?
I think that what we have to start doing is cheating.
Cheating,
right? Because the current development models are very, very technology averse. They don't really believe in tech fixes, but all the evidence that I see is that the West got to be the West because of a series of tech fixes that we applied relentlessly. And I'll give you an example of this, which is malaria nets. The studies that I've seen suggest that the impact of malaria nets in malarial areas on farmers is it roughly doubles their farming productivity, because they're not sick and their kids aren't sick, so they can actually spend more of their time farming. Well, that's not so difficult, is it? I mean, if we wanted to really fix poverty in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, if we could go around to all the farmers and give them malaria nets and it would double their farm output, that sounds like a win, doesn't it? And that's what I mean by cheating. I mean, you can actually apply tech fixes, and if you pick the right tech, it can work. And I think that there are a lot of examples of things that I would call the right tech. Solar water disinfection, SODIS, really cheap, gets rid of practically all of your waterborne disease problems. It's less than $1 per head per year. And it's a technology that people can teach each other pretty easily. So I think there are a lot of examples of technologies which could be applied to development that also have applications in disaster relief. So that we could actually take the capital that we're investing in these areas to deal with disaster and actually think about it as a single step where you deal with the disaster and the development problem in one step. And I don't think that we know how to do that fully effectively yet, but I think that there are some really very promising starts that are really worthy of further study. Reasonable answer?
I just think it's complicated. It's more complicated.
Well, I mean,
you have to convince everybody in sub-Saharan Africa that mosquito nets work.
Well, I mean, I'm willing to try handing them out, and if people don't use them, that's not my problem. Now, I realize that sounds a little hard.
That's not my problem. I mean, not to be argumentative.
No, please.
But that's development work. Development work is not handing out nets. Development work is convincing all of the villagers
mm-hmm.
that their productivity rate would be doubled.
Mm-hmm.
If it were as easy, if development work were as easy as putting up houses, that would be one thing. But
mm-hmm.
there's years of education and PR work that go in behind
yes.
the scenes, and I just
I think there are very deep questions about the development model at a fundamental level, very similar to the questions that I'm asking about disaster relief.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely agree that it's not that simple, or we'd be doing it that way already.
Right.
Right? I mean, there was a 70s generation where everybody thought appropriate technologies were going to solve the world's problems, and it just didn't.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because the technologies didn't work in many cases. So, yes, I mean, there are definitely deep questions there. But at the same time, I think that we've got at least a few answers which are fairly plug and play. And we have seen that some technologies, like the cell phone, you know, it just went. Television just went. The Land Rover just went. So if we can get something for water that just goes, and we can get something for cooking that just goes, then we've got really serious fixes for those kind of problems. And I think there is this need to say, well, in a lot of cases, the problems of getting technologies adopted are problems of the technologies, not problems with the transmission. You see what I'm saying? Like, if we'd gone to Africa and tried to give them landline telephones, it would have been basically impossible because the technology just wasn't right. And I think there's a lot of room for looking at this stuff and saying, well, a lot of the approaches to development are basically trying to give people landline telephones. The technology isn't right, no amount of coaxing will make it work. But figuring out which technologies are like that and which technologies would work if we could just get people educated, it's a minefield. But I think there's room there for some new approaches, and I think that starting with the disaster relief stuff as a vector for getting that stuff done makes a lot of sense. And one specific technology is solar water disinfection, where you take a bottle, a clear plastic bottle, like a soda bottle, you fill it with river water, you screw the lid on, you leave it in the sun for a day, and when you come back, the water is drinkable. It's been heated and treated with the ultraviolet light of the sun to the point where you can drink it safely. Well, I mean, that's a perfect technology for a lot of disaster areas. And it's also a perfect technology for when you leave. So that would be one candidate technology that I think could do this kind of combined dual function of disaster relief and development in a single step. Reasonable? I'm not expecting you to be convinced. I mean, there are real questions about this model. But at the same time, those questions are questions that are design questions. We can give this a try, maybe. Sorry, you had a question.
Well, sort of a comment to what you said. I of course, if you want to try to convince everybody before they start to use it, it would be extremely difficult. But if you get one or two to start, they will be the good example. And the neighbors will see what happens in a little while. And then it's, you know, so of course, it will be slower in the beginning, but if you can start a process like that, it can eventually go a lot quicker. It's not a linear type of development necessarily.
Yeah.
Plus, as you are indicating, many times the technology, whatever solution the Western world would think will work, is many times. Well, they're not usable for that condition. No thought at all has given into the local situation many times. So I know you want to set up this UN tent, for instance, with interior lighting so you can see right through it.
Oh, yeah.
And women will
classic.
Not use it, of course, because, you know, you can. There are plenty of examples like that.
Yes.
One important here with this project is really to give a lot of thought and thinking into not so much the technology aspect of it, but more the cultural aspects and GNS aspect, all those issues.
One of the core things about this, and this again is part of my perspective, is that a lot of what we call cultural aspects are simply usability testing.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, you know, the key to all of these technologies is you have to live in your own equipment.
Yeah.
You know, I've spent two and a half, three months in Hexyards, and it's not nearly enough. I need to be living in one of these things for a couple of years before I'm really going to be able to say this works. And most of the people doing shelter design, most of the people doing infrastructure design are not using their own equipment every day for 6 months or a year. And one of the things that I'm trying to get funded is a village where everybody can bring their equipment, use it, and live in it for years at a time. And at that point, we'll be able to say with some authority, yeah, this stuff works. Good enough for me, good enough for you, come along. And I think at that point, a lot of the issues that you think of as being cultural will turn out to be technical, or they'll turn out to be, you know, manufacturing problems. And then there'll be some issues which are genuinely cultural, but I think that, you know, living in your own equipment gets rid of most of the things that you think of as cultural.
I also know that the manager for the Swedish Rescue Agency, the international department who works basically every day with these problems, he said, when I presented this project idea to him, he said, this is the first time someone is approaching me with a project which is user-oriented and not, production-oriented or resource-oriented. Most of the time he has companies coming to him, well, you know, we have this equipment so we can produce this and this. They're not thinking really what is the problem, what we're going to solve. And
you've
that's most of the case, it's resource-oriented, and so we get what we ask for, basically.
And I mean, really, if you guys can find some way of spending, say, you know, 6 weeks or a month living in the shelters you design at the end of the year, you'll learn a lot. All right.
Okay.
So I want to
short break.
Short break. Every refresh your brains.
Ah, see, yeah, this will record audio, so we get an audio track from this. Okay.